Major Jefferson, Reel 11. If you are firing in support of a tax, what sort of firing were you doing? Was it formal barrage shooting?
Quite often, yes. For the major attacks I'm talking of and the dates I've, I hope, given you, those were quite formal barrages. I think we already had the ability to call down on key points like Target Lion Fire. I'm not 100% certain of that, but of course it was the artillery of the 4th Indian Division which were leaders in this principle of concentration of fire. And I think you will find that other experts recognised that although we had been used too often in penny packets, and indeed although the 4th Indian Division was seldom used in a concentrated way until much later in June, in the campaign, the actual divisional artillery had from quite an early stage been used in a concentrated way. Whether actually before the 2nd of November I was able to say Target Lion 10 rounds or whether that was a little later, I don't know, but certainly by 4 months later, I think, I suppose it's one of those dreams that people have, which when you come to investigate it, they're probably not exactly correct, but there are others than myself who believe that I was the first person to call for the core artillery on a target, and I think that was at the Jebel Ghazi at after Akrit. And certainly already we were trying to use our guns whenever possible in a concentrated way, and towards the end of Alamein, of course, 4th Indian Division, apart from patrolling, didn't have much of a part to play in the last battle of Alamein. Although we were always there, the infantry were always on Ruwaisat and just north of it, and we gradually edged round. It was the 5th Brigade, I think, that made the final breakthrough on the 2nd of November. But we weren't greatly involved in the dogfight other than being there. But we certainly fired very large quantities of shells during that time. And after the battle receded from us on the 2nd of November, of course the rains came, we were left for some days cleaning up the battlefield, and we eventually got ourselves into the Dairol Shine and found bottles of Chianti and things like that, and booby traps. But eventually, by just before Christmas of that year, we were at Al Adam on the escarpment there, and someone had the amusing idea of teaching Indians to climb mountains on the escarpment at Al Adam. It was there, from there on, that we became officially regarded as the mountain division of the 8th Army. We had a chap who then was Brigadier Hunt and later became Colonel Lord Hunt, and we did this really bit of mountain training on the escarpment of Ladham. And the only thing, other thing I can remember of that period is the fact that Wilkie and I think I showed you his actual ammo book with some of the sketches written in my handwriting last time you were here, we put on a concert at Al Adam on the hill, on the escarpment. It was not a very good concert, but I'm still very proud of having put on a concert at all under those circumstances. But then eventually, it must have been end of February, I think, in the meantime I'd done two things noteworthy from my own point of view. I'd done an attachment to the 10th Hussars, because they wanted to find out how we controlled guns. Only a week with them. But I spent this time with the 10th Hussars, and it was again, one had this question of being a weekend soldier with the 10th Hussars, or the 10th Hussars, you know. And I remember at the end having to do a shoot for them, and I opened up at a greatly exaggerated distance, and I remember being a gunner and bold and taking a 1600 yard bracket, which is quite a long bracket on something like 3600, and I dropped 1600 and halved it and got my line correction, and in three shots I was on the target. And I cursed myself to this day that I didn't have the sense to point out to them that the gunnery drill had allowed me with one shot to rescue myself from an embarrassingly bad estimate of the first range. Because if I'd taken an 800 yard racket, I would have not got on there quickly. Yeah? But I took a 1600 yard bracket and split it, and in three shots I was on the target. That was the 10th Hussars. I remember them happening. I don't know whether they'd remember me happening at all, because it was very much oil and vinegar in one sense. And it must have been at that time that I went on this mine course at Benghazi with Chalky White. Because, of course, as we went along the coast there, "Surty was dirty" was one of the favourite expressions. So the Africa Corps, they withdrew, had been extremely clever in laying mines in the coastal villages. But it didn't leave much of an impression with me, because I hardly ever saw human habitation the whole time I was in North Africa. Anyway, by early March, it must have been, we got to just outside Marath. And that's where the battle started again.
I'd like to ask you a bit more about Ruaisat. You said that while you were still around the ridge, you were attacked. What sort of attacks were put in on you?
I wasn't actually in the OP, so I can't really describe what went on at the sharp end. I remember one particular night I was actually in the gun position resting. I'd been in the OP the day before, and the attack came in, and I remember feeling rather pleased with myself, because I'd just had a bottle of whiskey from the Naffy, the first for some time, and I'd only had one sip out of it, and I sacrificed it to walking around the gardens to cheer people up. And at least one of my correspondents has remembered that occasion with gratitude, so it wasn't totally selfless.
But presumably these attacks were not pushed home, they weren't?
They were at the sharp end. The fighting was going on over, particularly over Western Point 63. As I say, I think we actually got onto it once. Well, I wasn't again with the leading people. I think the Germans got as far as Middle Point 63 on more than one occasion. But I was never, although I was 4 months on the Ruaisat Ridge, and the whole of that time, bar perhaps two periods of 48 hours, in contact with the enemy, in close contact with the enemy, in that bit of war, I never actually got recognisably into any sort of give or take position at the sharp end. Yeah.
When you were up on this scaffolding, OP, what sort of targets were you supposed to be observing from there? And where was it? Where was this?
It was, in fact, I actually identified it more closely than the last time. It was there is Western Point 63, there is Middle Point 63, and there is Rear Point 63. It was there on that track. There's a beer just there. I think I described this on the tape last time. The beer that's sometimes filled with water. The actual scaffolding was this side of the track, and we used to patrol quite often up that nullah there.
Towards the
Dare O'Shine. Towards the Dare O'Shine, yes. You can see this better on the other map if I had one, but this map only begins here. It's one of our problems. And the El Dava map ends there. I picked this out on a larger scale map, and that is its exact map reference, that beer, because it's shown in blue on that larger scale map, and I picked it out since you were last here.
Could you see into the Dare O'Shine?
No. You could see this ridge. See, I never saw into the Dare O'Shine until the 3rd or 4th of November.
You mentioned that when you went into the Dare O'Shine, there were booby traps. What sort of booby traps?
There were booby traps. Again, I didn't actually kick one. That's why I'm here. What I do remember is that it was Italian infantry there by now, and they had very happy little homes dug into the side of the Dare, and really quite safe, and provided they didn't put that over the wrong side. But a lot of things were booby trapped. Though I would not wish to give the impression that the Dare O'Shine itself was particularly booby-trapped. Everything was liable to be booby-trapped, and it got worse as it got on the Coast Road. But people didn't... On the Rawisat Ridge itself, a lot of the bodies were booby-trapped. So one was always careful.
You mentioned finding Chianti in the Italian positions. Yeah. What else had they left behind besides?
At one stage, I picked up a shotgun. I fairly quickly lost it. I forget whether that was before or after this particular episode, but I did have a shotgun at one stage, which they'd probably taken from us, and we had to back again and then lost again. Little Beretta automatics were fairly popular things to pick up. There was some of this sort of... Have you flown Air Italia? I always avoid them because they will insist upon giving you some sort of dog biscuit. There were these sort of dog biscuits that the Italians obviously like. But nothing... I don't think it's really noteworthy what one found there.
While you were... on the ridge, were you constantly moving position, having to move
the guns
backwards and forwards and turn?
We moved on several occasions, but no, we certainly didn't move constantly. We occupied their position, and we then almost certainly surveyed in alternative positions in case we got shelled out. And perhaps we would then occupy our alternative position for one night with two guns and fire a few rounds and go back again. But to some extent, they were semi-fixed brigade areas. And one moved for a perfectly good reason, to prepare for an attack or... because your brigade got moved 1,000 yards north or south.
Did they have proper gun pits with
cover. There we had dug in, and we had proper camouflage nets. In fact, 11th Field, it was Colonel Fowler, Colonel of the 11th Field, who by now was CRA of 1st Armoured Div, who developed a collapsible camouflage net. I've answered your question, I think, on that one. Yeah.
You mentioned that it was a bit like being oil and vinegar with the 10th Hussars. Were they all regulars?
Don't think so. Oh, they're very possibly. I mean, I just spent a year in the desert in a working gunner unit, and they were a bit Hooray Henry, as we would call them today. Yeah, and they were also nice chaps, and it was a holiday for me, except for the fact I had to go and do this exam, and if I hadn't been used a very large bracket, I would have failed it. But I don't know how they found it to have a almost a motor mechanic arrive in there, you know, compared to the life they were. They were used to leading even under battle conditions. Because I think this is one of the 11th Field's problems. One of the reasons why it no longer exists is that it had come from India. Our chaps, if they had wives, they were probably in India. Our supplies were cigarettes from India. I think to that extent we were a bit of a forgotten race, just like the 14th Army, in a different way were a forgotten army. We didn't have to go into Alexandria for leave, because we were an Indian div. In a few minutes' time, we're going to get through Marath, and we're going to be kept waiting 48 hours outside Gabies, so that the highway decorators can march through with their pipes playing. We could have taken it 48 hours earlier, but that didn't suit Montgomery's public relations people. And I suppose there was a little of that feeling in what I just said, but don't exaggerate it. It wasn't. You can exaggerate this extent that when I look back upon my war, one could have had a great deal more home comforts if one had gone at it from another angle.
Why was it that the 10th Hussars required you to?
Oh, well, I mean, it was fairly constant, fairly normal procedure for people to exchange, and it may well be that they had an intelligent colonel who said, look at these gunner chaps, they get up there and knock things about with shells, they have their procedures, let's find out what they are. I wouldn't think it was more than that. But it was just as I went on a mines course at Benghazi.
What sort of tanks did the 10th Hussars have?
They must have been, at that time, they weren't Shermans. There'd be the big British one. When I went off to for the Battle of Alam Halfa, I had a borrowed Matilda. And Matildas were a very good tank to have around, because they were heavy tanks. But I should think that the 10th Hussars would certainly have some Crusaders. But I think I was in a heavier tank than either a Matilda or a Crusader when I did my shoot. I can see the gun. I don't think it would be a Sherman. It may very well have been a Grant. I'm not 100% certain.
You mentioned Montgomery arriving. Yeah. What sort of impact did that have on the regiment, the change of command?
Well, we are all, and always have been, Auchinleck men. At the time, I suppose we didn't... immediately it didn't have much effect on us. I know that Montgomery didn't go down very well with some of the regular NCOs, and I think the officers were a bit suspicious of him. I think to an extent he won us over by the fact that in the end we won. But of course, I wouldn't have to talk to you about this if Montgomery hadn't played all sorts of shit tricks on Auchinleck. Auchinleck will always be one of my heroes, and I think one of the heroes of everyone who was in the desert at that time. He's a great man. Montgomery pinched Auchinleck's plans because we knew what was going to happen, and he then announced it as his own plan. The Battle of Alamhalfa, we had known about the rough plan for weeks past, and it was the Orcs' plan. And then Montgomery not only stole it, but he undoubtedly tried to eliminate any trace of the Auchinleck success. This battle of First Alamein, I don't blame Playfair for his volume ending on June the 30th and starting again on July the 5th, but I think it's very typical of everything that came down from the Montgomery command time, an undoubted conspiracy of silence. But he won, and that's what makes a good general.
Why was it, though, that at the time, as you say, he didn't go down well with some of the NCOs and the officers were suspicious of him?
Well, firstly, because we were all Auchinleck men. We knew that under the Orc, we knew from the 3rd of July that we'd stopped the German. And indeed, we knew that at 10:56 on the 3rd of July, Rommel had sent signals. We knew that very soon afterwards. And we'd just had a message from the Orc congratulating us on having done it. And it had been done. And we knew that the Battle of Alamhalfa was going to be fought roughly the way it was. I don't say exactly the way it was, but we expected the Germans to come round our left flank, and we expected to stay where we were. So, firstly, we were Orc men. And then Montgomery's physical appearance, squeaky voice, RAC hat with two badges on it, rude, non-smoking, cocky, I've just used a collection of adjectives that most people would not use for a hero. Later on he won, and one can never get over that. I'm talking about our sentiments at the time, yeah? Not necessarily, and subsequently, sentiments, not a rational appreciation. Though even on a rational appreciation, I mean, he waited until long after the Orc would have waited and got a great deal more physical material to fight the umpteenth Alamein with than the Orc would have done. Okay, that makes him a good general, but it doesn't make him loved. And of course, at a later stage in the war, and this probably affects my longer appreciation, our longer appreciation of him, in Italy, he said to us one day, "I shall never leave you." And the next day he was on an aeroplane leaving us. Maybe a very good deception plan for the Germans, but it doesn't endear him to the people he's left behind. Yeah?
Another thing I'd like to talk about is the replacement of casualties. Now, you had a fair number of casualties in those early days in July. How were they replaced? How was the You were saying?
Yeah. On the 25th of July, having been down to 187, I think was the actual nominal roll of the regiment on the 3rd of July, with an establishment of 561, we had by then got a strength of 382. We still needed three WO2s, two staff sergeants, 19 sergeants, 28 bombardiers and 127 gunners. Although we'd already been made up with several drafts, including at least three officers from the RA base depot. And we'd also had one or two joiners I've already described from 164 Field and 32nd Field.
Where did the other ranks come from? Were they also from the base depot?
I think at that time they would probably largely were. Of course, we were already, by the 25th of July, we were already getting some of our wounded back.
How did these new arrivals settle in? How long did it take them to actually get integrated into the regiment and become fully effective?
I don't think I was ever conscious, really conscious of any who weren't effective, particularly at that time, because most of the chaps had already got a fair amount of service in, in general, and desert service in particular in. I think the answer is more that you don't notice that a small group is themselves below standard or difficult to assimilate, but that when you've assimilated several groups, your standards have lowered ipso facto. Yeah? In any case, our cadre was for the